Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget our pre-debate coverage. Tomorrow night I'll be hosting beginning at 8 o'clock, and then the live coverage of the debate begins at 9, the final Bush-Kerry debate on domestic policy issues, live on AM 820 WNYC. And now, why two New Yorkers who have served 12 years in prison for a well-known murder may be innocent, and how the justice system should decide. David Lemus and Omado Hidalgo have been in prison for 12 years, convicted of killing a bouncer at the Palladium nightclub on 14th Street in 1990. But evidence is piling up that perhaps they didn't do it, including a confession by another man and an apparent misidentification by a witness of a key person at the scene. The jury forewoman who convicted the two and a former prosecutor who came into some of the exonerating evidence are on board with this. Manhattan DA Robert Morgenthau is not. There is no DNA evidence to prove anything conclusively, so in a physical sense. So how is the justice system to decide if these long-suffering convicts should be freed? With me now are the jury forewoman in the case, Carol Kramer. She's a magazine editor in real life. And Judge Abraham Gurgis from the New York State Supreme Court. He's the editor of The Jurist magazine, a publication of the New York State Supreme Court Justices Association, and he is a former president of that association. So, Judge Gurgis, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's always nice being here.
And Ms. Kramer, thank you very much for doing this.
Well, thank you.
And let me go to you first. Ms. Kramer, how did you get re-involved in this case after so long?
One day this summer I was getting ready to go to work, and I heard a promo on the Today Show about these two men wrongfully convicted and how there was going to be a special that night. And I looked at the pictures, and I couldn't believe it, and because for 12 years I thought they were absolutely guilty. And so I read up on it, I nexused it, and I read all the Times stories, and I decided, yes, they were not guilty, and I, you know, felt terrible, so I tried to find one of their lawyers, and I finally did, and I emailed him and said, could I help?
So give us a little bit of the evidence before we get into sort of the judicial process here. What did you see that made you decide that these people who you had weighed the evidence against and decided that they committed a murder were in fact innocent?
The first thing that hit me was that they weren't even there that night, and they didn't know each other. They didn't even speak the same languages. I don't know that that could have been introduced in court, but when I've told my co-jurors about it, that changes their minds immediately. This was a crime that was, you know, undertaken by gang members. They had to be friends. If these people didn't know anybody, they didn't know each other, mm-hmm. There was no way they could do this.
And not being at the scene would be rather relevant. How did you come to that conclusion?
They had alibis, I learned, but the alibis, one came in too late, and the other, one of the defense attorneys didn't, he thought that it was a compromised alibi, so he didn't introduce it. I have to say that they had not really great legal help, either of the men, and the jury knew that all the while.
Okay, so Judge Gurgis, this comes back to the judicial system. These gentlemen are still in prison, and what happens?
Brian, I just want to preface by saying that I'm not permitted to speak on a specific case. The canon of ethics prohibited me from doing it, but let me speak about the general approach. After trial, there are two approaches that for review. One is you go to the appellate division. In New York, for example, you go to the appellate division, First Department, which is right here, and they review the case, and they can go into everything. There is no limitation of where they can go. And they see if any errors were made during the trial, and they can reverse the case. And I'm sure in this instance they looked at the case as well.
They did. But our judge wouldn't hear it. He said that the confession wasn't, you know, reputable enough.
No, but that isn't the judge now. That's a whole, you know, very few people. One of the reasons I go on radio is because so few people understand how the judicial system works. And really, for public education, it is so important that people understand the process, forgetting about the individual case. An appellate court looks at the case completely and can go into the facts, can go into the law, and can go into the interest of justice when they look at the whole case. But they don't look at new evidence. That's not what they have to do. Their look at it is as the case as it was tried. Then there is what's called a 440 motion, which a defendant could make, where, in fact, there is new evidence that's been discovered, and I think that's what you're really talking about in a case like this. Where there is new evidence being that has been discovered, the original judge who handled the case, if he's still on the bench, of course, will review the new issues. And that is, for example, there was evidence that wasn't there available at the time of the trial, that if you really try to find that evidence, you couldn't find it because it's something new. For example, a confession of somebody that they actually did this that comes up 2 years later. That's new evidence in a case.
So it's that kind of proceeding that you're describing that was held in this case.
Judge Gold looked at that and decided that he didn't hold by that confession, and he said that our jury had, you know, been dispassionate and deliberate, which we had. But if we had known about this confession, believe me, our jury would never have convicted them.
Right. So tell us about this confession. Who confessed? How do you know about it, and why did the judge reject it?
It was made to an assistant U.S. Attorney, Steve Cohen. He was investigating gangs in the Bronx. And he was trying to gather information from a witness, and he said, well, you know, you haven't told me everything. And the guy said, oh, you mean the Palladium? Yeah, I did that with Spanky. And Spanky has even since been interviewed by the assistant DA and said that given immunity, he would tell people what happened that night.
So I mean, Spanky, as far as you're concerned, is the other killer.
He's the other killer, and he's walking the streets right now because nobody will do anything about this.
Well, let me just give you an overall picture of a judge who's looking at an issue like this. The first thing one would say, and I'm not talking about this case now, I'm talking about in general, is there a reason why this new person says, I did it? Is he getting paid for saying that I did it?
I think that he not only has said it, his accomplice has said it, and they have at least 12 affidavits of people who said that he was there.
Right. You're looking at questions of what motivation he might have to lie about whether
that's correct. And a judge will usually, and I'm not talking about this specific case, I don't know the facts of this case, nor will I speak about it because I guess it's still pending. A judge will hold a hearing, will bring those people in front, the person who might say, I did it, and bring that person in front of them and have a hearing on it and see whether or not that person is credible. I have a similar case going on right now in my courtroom. I'm holding hearings on it, and I will then look at it, see whether what is happening is credible or not. A lot of people might say I did something when in fact they didn't do something. Some people even get paid where they have nothing to lose.
Well, there is no evidence of that here, and I think there's enough corroborating evidence that these people, you know, did it. In fact, the sister-in-law of one had told the police a week after the crime that her brother-in-law had done it, but that evidence was never given to the defense attorneys.
In fact, Carol Kramer, isn't there a police report? That's one of the things now in this case.
Two Bronx homicide detectives on their own, you know, thought this was fishy, and they asked to reexamine it, and they did, and they concluded the same thing that I've concluded. These men did not do it. The wrong two men are in jail. You know, and as much as I feel guilty that I convicted two innocent men, I am outraged that the real person is still walking the streets. He's still dangerous.
You know, one of the things that you should be aware of is that it's called Rosario material. Or other kinds of material. If the district attorney is aware that there is evidence that would be helpful to the defendant prior at the time of the trial, not after the trial, now we're talking about prior to the trial, they are under an obligation to turn that evidence over to defense counsel. Otherwise, that is a direct reason for a reversal.
Well, I think that's
so the issue really is when the information became available. Did it become available prior to the trial or after the trial?
Yeah, the same detective, Vicky Garcia, interviewed the person who told her that that the brother, her brother-in-law did it. Yes, that material was available. The DA says that he gave it, but there's no physical evidence, nothing written, that proves that they gave this to the defense attorneys.
This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC. We are reconsidering the convictions of two men who have served 12 years for the murder of a bouncer at the Palladium nightclub in 1990, with the forewoman of the jury who convicted them at the time, who now has concluded that they are innocent, and with Judge Abraham Gurgis, who is here not specifically in relation to this case, but in his position as someone who does judicial education for the public, to talk about the way things work. And as we hear, this has been very frustrating so far for Carol Kramer and the other people who are trying to have these convictions overturned and these men set free. Our phones are open, 212-267-WNYC. We can take a couple of calls on this, 267-9692. And Carol Kramer, how are you feeling about the justice system right about now?
I've gone 360 degree turn. You know, I used to be a real law and order person. I used to say, you know, the police are right, criminals get what they deserve. When I see how many things have slipped through here and how little the jury knew, I mean, I think our jury was, we were victims as well as these two men. We were not told enough evidence. I think there probably was a Brady and a Rosario violation here. I've read through the transcript of the trial. I've read all the affidavits. These guys are innocent, and I feel terrible. And I, you know, I would never serve on another jury. I'd have to say, look, I'm not going to convict because I don't believe a word that's coming out of anybody's mouth.
Should she have wound up so cynical?
Well, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Being a juror is so important in this day and age when our whole system of government is being questioned, and that's what's really happening overseas and so forth. As I say to jurors, you play the second most important role of any citizen, and that is being a juror. The first being, of course, during wartime, being in the armed forces. We're not perfect. The system is far from perfect. But one of the things that one has to understand is that there is a constant review. I think the legal system is one of the few places where there is a review of other people. See, that's the important thing. That judge, whatever that judge's decision was, can be reviewed by another court of other people. And then there's a third court after that, in the event in the Court of Appeals, for example, in our state, that reviews what the middle court does. It's far from perfect, but I presume this is an ongoing case, and we don't know what the end of the story will be yet.
Carol Kramer?
Isn't there a general reluctance, though, to overthrow a jury's decision? I mean, everything I've read made it sound like we had issued the Ten Commandments and it was chiseled in stone. And, you know, why can't it be reviewed more quickly?
It is reviewed. Sometimes I agree. I think there is a frustration with reference to the amount of time that's involved. Certainly, an innocent person who's sitting in jail each day is a lifetime to that person. And I know in my courtroom, I try to say that very, very specifically that you don't understand what it is to be in jail, and one should expeditiously do whatever it is. If a person is guilty, that's fine, but we have a presumption of innocence, and we should be expediting all of these things as quickly as possible.
When I started to read all the newspaper stories about this, there was an interesting quote from a law professor saying that the courts are reluctant to overturn these because if we really knew how many innocent people were sent to jail, the system would just fall apart.
Well, the courts are reluctant to overturn a jury verdict. I've done it once, actually, when I thought that the defendant was innocent. I was reversed the
on
higher
appeal,
court.
Really?
I've only been reversed three or four times since I've been on the bench.
Now, were you reversed because the appellate court decided that the person was guilty or because they decided you didn't have the right?
I didn't have the right at that point.
Let's take a phone call from a criminal defense attorney, Brian in Manhattan. Thank you for calling.
Morning, Brian.
Hi.
I want to applaud the forewoman for coming forward in the case. It's very rare in these kind of cases. Most jurors, they do their duty, and then thereafter they don't want to be bothered with it. And I applaud her for realizing that there are people's lives at stake. But also just wanted to make the comment that you have a Rosario and a Brady violation that occurred here, and ordinarily those violations are discovered just by fluke. not because the prosecutor ever turns over that information.
Really?
And I think, yeah, I've had a number of cases like that, and we've had those in my office. And I think that shows that, just as you were saying, there are a number of people who are innocent, who have claims of innocence, that are in prison, and we'll never know, because we're never going to discover these Brady and Rosario violations.
Brian,
I think we're all more willing to address this now that we've seen all the DNA cases that have caused reversals in the death penalty. If there are that many reversals there, then how many more are in these smaller cases?
Brian, I'm curious to get your take as a defense attorney, even though you may not be familiar with this case, and Carol, your take on if this judge who you went before and the Manhattan DA, Robert Morgenthau, are reluctant to declare these guys not guilty when you and obviously a lot of other people, including those who professionally work in the system, are so convinced that they are not guilty. Why do you think they're throwing up these roadblocks? Carol?
Well, what I said before, that if we really knew how many there were like this, it would be too embarrassing. The Central Park joggers, case proved that. In fact, I think that the Bronx detectives who brought this up did it around the time that that information was released, and I think that two of those in a row is embarrassing.
Brian, do you think that's it? D.A. Morgenthau doesn't want to lose face, neither does this judge who's not a public figure particularly?
Not wanting to lose face, and also it takes a lot of courage. We're still living in the shadow of an attitude about, you know, being tough on crime means keeping people locked up no matter what. And I think people still believe they have to have those law and order credentials to have a political future. And actually says that the prosecutor's duty is to do justice,
Judge,
to find out the truth.
Do you think those things come into play?
Let me just indicate that I don't believe any judge or any district attorney who believes that someone is innocent will, in fact, keep that person in jail because they're concerned about their own political being. As a matter of fact, it's just the reverse. I would imagine that a district attorney would be more concerned that someone who is innocent be released those purposes.
I'm sorry, I could never believe that again. I might have 3 months ago.
You're talking about an individual case, and an individual case, these cases are quite complex. The issue, I'm sure that a hearing was held. I don't know if people were present in hearings. Very often they read about what's going on. They don't sit there all day long, and they don't analyze the people who are testifying.
What's left to do in this case, Carol? Is it over?
I think that Assistant DA Bibb has said that he, on October 29th, his office would say where they were going. They've conducted an investigation for 2 years. It was one that they thought was only going to take 6 weeks. And he's been all over the country interviewing people in prisons, and almost every one of them says, yeah, Spanky did it, Joey did it. I don't know how many more people he needs. I mean,
Carol Kramer, the forewoman of the jury in the Palladium nightclub bouncer murder case 12 years ago, now convinced that the people she helped to convict are innocent. Judge Abraham Gurgis, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
For an important discussion. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.